We're in a series following the life of Abraham, and in particular, Abraham's journey with his God. And so in your Bibles, you can go ahead and turn to Genesis chapter 13. We're going to start there and move pretty quickly to chapter 14. But we've been looking at his life, and along this journey, Abraham's faithfulness to his God has been a lot like a roller coaster. There are times in Abraham's life where he showed great faith and times where he also showed incredible doubt. And that will continue as we go throughout the story of his life. But in this particular section here, Abraham is just coming out of a season of doubt. And in this new season, he's going to choose to trust God with where his life is going. And so the question is this: when we're at the top of the roller coaster, when we actually have the kind of faith that we always say we want to have, what does life look like? What are our choices? What are our decisions? And today we're going to get a sense of what that might be as we look into Abraham's life. Before we jump into it, though, I do want to share with you a little bit of a story. My middle schoolers over there just heard this 2 weeks ago, so sorry, guys. Repeat, I guess. I guess I was like eight, and my sister would have been five. We were at a carnival, and we were playing some of those carnival games. You know the kinds of games that are impossible to win? They're rigged, so you can't possibly. Like, there's like the 3-point shot, but then you go to the side and you find out that the rim is squished in it, so you can't ever make it. Or like you try and throw a ping pong ball in a plastic cup, it always bounces out. Those games are designed to defeat you. That's their whole point. But we got to one particular game, and my sister wanted to give it a shot because she saw that one of the prizes was this tiny little stuffed dog that she kind of wanted. And so she was going to give it a go, even though we knew that the odds were against us. And the game, it looked like this. You had a bowling ball on rails, and the goal was to push the bowling ball over the bump that's kind of just slightly off the middle there and have it rest in the valley. The problem is everyone tends to make one of two mistakes. One is you don't push it hard enough, and the bowling ball never gets over the bump in the first place. The other, which is way more common, is people push it too hard, and you clear the bump, but then the momentum of the ball causes it to go up that ramp at the back, and it goes all the way back to the start instead of resting in the valley where you want it to be. And so my sister gave this a shot. She paid some money to get 3 tries at this game. And at 5 years old, it just wasn't going to happen for her. She, despite her best effort, couldn't even get it over the bump. That just wasn't going to happen. So I decided to give this thing a go. And here's the thing, as much as these carnival games are rigged so you can't beat them, these carnival game makers were not prepared for 8-year-old Chris Conway. As it turns out, 8-year-old me was perfectly suited to beat this game. It required no strategy on my part whatsoever. All it required was that I give it a substantial push with my 8-year-old strength. So I get up there, I get to the bowling ball, I give this thing a shove, and it begins to go up the rails and begins to just barely go over the bump, just barely, coming back down into the valley, up the ramp on the side, back down to the valley, starts to go back up the bump, but it doesn't go over. It just rests nicely in the valley. I beat the carnival game. Oh, thank you, thank you. Clearly, the attendee there was shocked. This was like something that almost never happened. So she kind of like woke up out of a trance. Like, well, what am I supposed to do now? I have to give this kid a prize. So there before me are all of the prizes that I could pick for having a victory there at this game. And there's a little stuffed dog that my sister wanted. And so what do you think that I, as the gracious older brother in this situation, chose to do? I chose a pig for myself, of course. Yes, it was a cute pig. We have in our lives a lot of choices to make. Sometimes we make good ones, sometimes we make bad ones. But these choices, they confront us often. And these choices, in many ways, kind of show us how we relate to the world around us. That particular day, it was showing that I was not being particularly mindful of my sister. Abraham, as he will later be renamed, had to make some decisions. He had to make some choices. If you were here last week, you know that he just had come out of Egypt. He fled to Egypt to escape famine, thinking that Egypt would have better provisions for him there, despite the fact that God was promising to provide for Abraham. And so Abraham went to Egypt. It went very poorly. And so now Abraham is back in the original land where God had kind of set him up. And during this time, he had begun to acquire a lot of wealth, as did his nephew Lot. They began to acquire a lot of possessions. And it got to the point where they had so many possessions that their herdsmen were starting to get into conflict with each other. And they knew they were not going to be able to stay in the same area for very long. They had to part ways. Now, Abram, being the older of the two, would have had the first say at what section of land he wanted for himself. That would have just been how things went. He could have told Lot to go anywhere else, and Lot, being the younger one, would have just by custom of the day had to just obey Abram and go somewhere else. Abram, however, had decided at this juncture that he really wanted to trust God with where he ended up. See, he had this right in front of him, a right that he could claim for his own. He could choose the land that he wanted. But he also felt like, at this point, I want to release what is rightfully mine and let God continue to be on this journey with me. I want to see where God takes me. And so Abram is going to make a different kind of choice. You get three tries at this game, right? So I get up for my second try because it's only one. I got it first try. I get up to the bowling ball. I give it a good 8-year-old shove. The thing begins going up the rail, up the bump. Just barely makes it, goes down the valley, goes up the slope, back down the valley, starts to go back up the bump, but doesn't clear it. Just rests nicely in the valley. Two in a row. At this point, the carnival attendant's like convinced that somehow I'd rigged the game. She'd never seen anything like that before. She's just baffled. She's like, okay, well, here's what you get to do. You can either have another second smaller prize, or you can exchange your previous prize for a medium-sized prize. And so, with my sister next to me still wanting the little stuffed dog, and me assessing the situation before me, what do you think I chose to do? Yeah, I definitely gave her the small pig to get a bigger pig. Absolutely, yeah. So now I had a medium pig. You know, this was awesome. This pig was great. And so I was super stoked. Abram did not make the same decision. He decided to give Lot the first pick. And so Lot now is going to assess what is in front of him and make his decision based on what seems good to him. And Abram is going to live with the consequences of Lot's decision. Lot, however, did not choose to go where he wanted to go simply because he wanted to follow God. He began to choose his location based on what seemed to be the most pleasant land. And so here's what we read in Genesis chapter 13, verse 10. It goes like this. Lot looked around and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan toward Zoar was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And we'll actually read about that in chapter 19. Lot is seeing land that looks really good, looks like Egypt. They just got out of Egypt. They just experienced misery in Egypt. But here, Lot is still yearning for something that reflects that kind of grandness. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. The two men parted company. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. Lot chose his land based on what looked like it would be good soil. And so we guess that it was probably something like this. This is a little bit of a hypothetical. We don't know exactly where Abram or Lot would have been, but it probably looks something like this. Abram ended up going a little bit more toward the coast, a little bit further west. And Lot would choose the area right below the body of water where there's a river running through. So lands were going to be greener. This seemed really good to Lot. The problem, of course, is that he entered into a land that was morally suspect and in political turmoil. As we read more about what Sodom and Gomorrah are up to, you start to understand just how depraved the people of those cities were. Lot was inserting himself into a situation that was going to be very morally difficult. And they were also going to be in the midst of a significant amount of political turmoil, as we'll find out in a minute. So go ahead and turn to Genesis 14. This is where we're actually going to spend the bulk of our morning. And this passage is kind of fun, if not somewhat obscure. A lot of us, even if we've been Christians for a long time, may not remember this particular passage. It's not one that gets talked about a whole lot, in part because it's a little bit complicated. So we're going to look at this passage, and we're going to try to figure out what was going on here in Genesis 14. And what we really have, what we see off the bat, is a war of nine armies. Just recently there was a Hobbit movie that was the Battle of Five Armies, right? So Tolkien's got nothing on this. This is nine armies that are going to clash here. And Abram and Lot, as often happens in the Old Testament, the protagonists are going to find themselves caught up in somebody else's problem. And they're going to find themselves caught up in the wars and the issues of their day. And how is Lot going to respond to these kinds of things? What are they able to do? What is happening to them? We're going to try and go through this here, but the first 12 verses, rather than read them, we're going to try to map them out. We're going to try to visually understand what was happening here and how Lot got himself into a little bit of a pickle. All right, so here we go. Lot, which is kind of the green box that's now behind all those orange boxes, he was surrounded by these five cities, these five kings, all of whom were allied together. Abram is still off by himself. He's actually making some pretty cool friends that we'll see in a little bit. He's hanging out with some good people. Lot, on the other hand, is stuck in the midst of some people who aren't good and are going to be a little bit rebellious. See, there were four kings in the north. In particular, the king of Elam on the side there had, at some point in time, exerted some kind of military dominance over the five kings in the south. And as a result, each year, they would have to pay tribute. They'd have to give of their wealth, of their goods, and send them up to the north and to the east as sort of a tribute so that they wouldn't be attacked, essentially. They were afraid of the military might of Elam and his allied kings in the north. Well, as often happens, you don't want to be paying tribute forever. And so after 12 years of this, in all likelihood, they saw some sort of an opportunity. They decided to rebel in the 13th year. And so in the 13th year, they decided, we're not going to pay the tribute. Now, they probably decided they could do this because of some other turmoil that was happening. Cities were always going to war with each other. There was likely infighting or other disputes happening up north and to the east that were making the five kings of the south think, they can't do anything. They can't touch us. They're busy with their own stuff. And it seems like, for a while, they were probably right, because it's going to take a full year before the kings in the north rally together to do anything about the rebellion in the south. But they do. They come together as four allied kings and begin to make their way toward the rebellious kings in the south. But they're not just going to go straight there. These are four powerful armies. Very powerful armies. And so along the way, they're going to kind of conquer other different cities and locations, plundering, taking whatever wealth they can get a hold of. This wasn't an empire situation. They're not trying to annex these lands into their own lands, not yet. This is just a situation where we're going to come in and take all your stuff and leave. That was it. And they wanted to do this ultimately with the five kings in the south because they were not paying tribute anymore. We're going to come in, take all your stuff, and we're going to leave. So they did. They started making their way down, never losing a single battle, finally got to the five kings in the south. And there was a battle, and you can read about it, but we don't get a lot of information. All we know is very quickly, the five kings are defeated, gone. They flee. The kings themselves flee. Their men flee into the hills. Some lower themselves into pits, trying to just avoid being captured by the enemy. And as a result, Sodom and Gomorrah, in particular, are ransacked. The kings in the north take all of their possessions, as we'll find out in a minute, a lot of their people as well, presumably to sell into slavery. Having what they want, they're now going to start to make their way back home. One of their prizes, however, was Lot. Since he was in the midst of all of this, he also was taken captive, and his stuff was taken as well. So Lot now finds himself stuck up north without a lot of help. This is his situation. It's probably at this point that he realized the mistake he made in choosing to live in a place like that, choosing to live in a place where really anything could happen at any moment by people who are not very good people. So here he is now, alone, captive by these four kings in the north, without really any recourse except the distant hope that maybe Abram would take note. Now, the problem is, Abram, he wasn't exactly connected to the internet at the time, and so the news of the war had not spread all around the region until Lot was already well up to the north. But a survivor manages to make his way over to Abram's camp, and so we're going to read that. Go ahead and turn to verse 13 in Genesis chapter 14. Looks like this. A man who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. Now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol and Aner, all of whom were allied with Abram. So Abram learns of the news. He now knows that Lot, his kin, is stuck up north in captivity with no one to help him except possibly Abram. And so Abram has to make a choice. Is he going to leave behind the comfort of the wealth and possessions he'd accumulated and risk his life to go try to save his kinsmen from an army that had yet to be beaten? Would he put it all on the line? Would he go up there? Would he try? It's a choice that, like he had to make earlier in choosing whether or not to let Lot get his pick of the land, he had to leave up to God. Would God see him through? Would God show up? Would God give him victory? Would God provide? Abram, we'll find out in a few verses, but I'll go ahead and just tell you this now. Abram was going to go through this battle not by himself. He was going to have some friends with him, and he was going to ask God to be there with him. And to do this, he made an oath with God that if he went to go get back Lot, and if he got all the possessions back, that he would not keep any of it. Everything that belonged to someone else would be returned to that person. The things that belonged to the king of Sodom would be returned to the king of Sodom. Things that were Lot's would be given back to Lot. He wasn't going to take any wealth out of this. This was simply a victory that he was asking God to grant him on behalf of his kinsmen. And so, when Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He rallied his troops, the men within his own household, also probably the men that were his friends, as we learn later. They probably had men of their own. And this ragtag group of people begins to go north to take on an army that seemed invincible. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. Against all odds, and through a very fun military tactic, Abraham caught them off guard. And his men surrounded the camp, were able to essentially scare them so much that the king's forces had to flee. It wasn't about destroying those forces. That wasn't Abraham's goal. He didn't need to destroy everybody. He just had to scare them enough that they left in such a hurry that they left everything else behind. And to that end, he succeeded. Abraham and his friends, they successfully pushed them out of the north, began sending them home so that they would never come back, or at least not for a very long time. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the woman and the other people. He was successful in getting everything he had sought to collect. He got it back and was beginning to take it home. Just to finish mapping this out, you've got Lot. He's surrounded by these armies there. Abram is making his way north to him. That's when he does his little sneaky tactic, scares him in the night, and begins to disperse them all. And so they're out of the way. So Abram now has Lot, as Lot's possessions, as well as everything else that was taken from Sodom and Gomorrah, all the possessions, all the people. All of that now is in Abram's care. And this presents an interesting conundrum, because when you have a lot of fun things right in front of you, things that you could take, things that if you just, push a bowling ball the right way, you can get for yourself, what do you do? Abram had a choice to make, because God had given him victory, and before him was all the spoils of that victory. And he could take it for himself. And he could even say that God had delivered it to him. But that wasn't the journey that Abram had agreed to be part of. That wasn't the plan. In verse 17, the king of Sodom begins to come up to meet Abraham. And shortly after that, another man by the name of Melchizedek comes as well. Melchizedek is kind of an unusual character. We're going to see him once in the Old Testament, but the New Testament talks about him a lot. So if you want to learn more about Melchizedek, go to Hebrews chapters 5 through 7. They're going to talk about this guy a lot. But he's kind of a unique character, because he's going to say some things that, quite frankly, are surprising to me that anyone else in the Old Testament at this point could say. Here's what happens in verse 18. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of the heaven and earth. And praise be to God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand." And then Abram does this funny thing here. Then Abram gives him a tenth of everything, of all of it. He gives it to this king of Salem, this high priest. And the reason it's a little bit baffling is because this is a high priest of the land of Canaan. So this is a guy who would kind of be like the head of sort of a pagan order, as far as we could understand. This wouldn't be someone, as we know it, to be a priest of the God. That wasn't a concept that really anyone else seemed to have, except possibly Abram. But it shouldn't really surprise us, because even as God was pursuing Abram, he was probably pursuing other people. We don't really know their stories. They're not recorded in Scripture the same way. But somehow Melchizedek, in his pursuit of the divine, had come to know the same God that Abram was coming to know. And he came to realize that this God was the creator of everything. There was only one God who was over all. And it's the same God who was with Abram during the battle. This God who made everything that we have before us was the God who was bringing Abram through the fight. And so this wasn't Abram's battle. This wasn't Abram's victory. This was God's victory. This was going to set a precedent for the rest of the Old Testament. This is the first military campaign that we see in the Old Testament. You'll see more, and it will involve oftentimes the people of Israel. And at times they will trust that God will provide and deliver, and at times they won't. And oftentimes your success is tied to where they are in a given moment. But time and time again, as we go through the Old Testament, we find out that when the people of God succeed, it's never because of anything they did, it's because their God was with them. Their God was providing for them, and their God was seeing the story all the way through. Abram learned this on that day. And this is a powerful God. A God who, when he makes a promise to you, is going to see that promise through. A God that can be depended on, even in the midst of uncertainty. And this was a God that Abram wanted to continue to follow, to continue to journey with. And he knew that by taking the goods that were in front of him, by breaking his oath, he was going to be missing out on the journey. He was going to choose the blessings of God rather than God himself. So another character shows up. This is the king of Sodom. King of Sodom shows up. He has a very different aim than Melchizedek did. The king of Sodom is just trying to essentially get back whatever he can. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and keep the goods for yourself." This actually would have been fairly status quo for the day, that if another army came and defended your city, they were essentially entitled to all the goods of your city. They weren't necessarily entitled to the people. However, there's nothing the king of Sodom can do about it. His forces are scattered. And so he's hoping that just by Abram's goodwill, Abram will keep the stuff but return the people. That's kind of all he can bank on at this point, hoping that Abram will be generous in this way. He can't begin to understand that for Abram, something much bigger than the spoils of war is happening right now. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "With raised hand I have sworn an oath to the Lord, God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, that I will accept nothing belonging to you. Not even a thread or the strap of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, 'I made Abram rich.' I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me. To Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them have their share." The king of Sodom honestly wouldn't have known what to make of this, probably just really grateful to get his stuff back and peace out. But Abram knew that if he had taken the things that were in front of him, if he'd taken the goods of Sodom, then at some point in time, that would probably come back to bite him. Inevitably, Sodom would get in another war, and now they'd probably expect Abraham to help out. Or some people would begin to say that Abraham was just as morally suspect as all the people in Sodom and Gomorrah were. Those things are all true. But more than anything, he had made an oath to God. He wasn't going to break it for stuff. He was going to stay on this journey with the God who had taken him so far. That was the choice he wanted to make. So I get one more try. At this point, the carnival attendant is looking at me intently, like, what's this kid going to do? How is he going to rig this game? I go up to the bowling ball. An 8-year-old me just gives it a solid shove. It begins to go along the rail, starts to go up the bump, and just for a moment, I don't think it's going to make it over. But it does, just almost resting on top before it rolls back down the valley, up the slope, back down the valley, and it's not going to go over the bump this time. It's going to go straight back into the valley. 3. The attendant's on the floor at this point. Like, this is so beyond anything she's seen. She's almost afraid that, like, somehow she's doing her job wrong. Like, am I going to get fired for this? I don't know. And so here's what happens when you have successfully completed this game 3 times in a row, as it turns out. She kind of maybe even had to look it up. There was this other row of prizes, these ginormous stuffed animals that were bigger than I was. And so you had your option. You could take another little small prize, like a particular stuffed dog, Or can I exchange my medium-sized pig for a large stuffed animal? So with my sister standing there, knowing that she wanted this little stuffed dog, what do you think me, as the older brother, in my generosity, chooses to do? Of all the large animals, none were a pig. So I kept my pig, and I got the dog and gave it to my sister. I know, my benevolence has no bounds. All right. 8-year-old me couldn't understand something that day that I understand better now, and I started to understand even after I'd given her the dog. The whole thing there wasn't really about the stuffed animal. I mean, yeah, she did want the dog. But what was more significant for her, what's more memorable to her, is that her older brother got her something. Her older brother had sacrificed something on her behalf. I was talking to her earlier this week, and she doesn't even remember the dog. What we oftentimes do as people is focus on the blessing, the things, the stuff. And that is all oftentimes very good because it's the God of the universe who gave those things to us, happily gave those things to us. But when the blessings distract us from the one who blesses, we start to miss out on the real prize. When we choose the blessings over the blesser, then we lose out on the journey that Abraham got to experience. And by declining wealth that day, wealth that was rightfully his, Abram chose something greater, the God who was taking him on this journey. That day, he chose the blesser, and that would make all the difference in his life. The thing about Christianity is this. It doesn't work well as a side dish to the main course of our life. Sometimes we like to treat it as such, and sometimes I'll hear people use language to the effect of, I'm going to go to church today to work on the spiritual side of myself. That's good. I'm glad. Anytime you come to church, I believe that God will meet you there, and it'll be a great, good experience. But even that language, it's based on me. I want to develop something to make my life better. I want my life to be better than it is right now. I'm looking for more blessings. And so I think maybe perhaps by going to church today, I can get more blessings. The thing about Christianity, and the reason why it doesn't play well with other systems of thoughts or other belief sets, not because any of them are bad or because they get it all wrong, it's just this. The God of the universe, who gave up everything for us, is asking us to give up everything for him. And sometimes that includes the very things he gave us in the first place. Sometimes the very things that God gave us, the things that we hold to for comfort and security, because they make us feel good, because sometimes we even measure our worth in relation to God based on what he has given us, those are the blessings. Never bad, but never as good as the blesser. And so what do you do when you have the faith to follow God on this journey? What do we do when we actually live up to what we say we want to be, when we want to follow God wherever he takes us? Well, sometimes it means that we have to set aside the things that we've become so comfortable with, the things that are maybe even rightfully ours, in pursuit of what God has next. Because whatever's next is going to be better. Abraham is kind of an example of this to us. He's going to make this choice time and time again to follow God, but he's also going to make the choice time and time again to doubt and to not follow. And it's going to continue to be a roller coaster. It's not going to be all good from here on out. And we'll see that as we go through this series. But here's the thing. This story, this whole narrative of Abraham, it isn't actually about Abraham's faith. We talk about that a lot. It's talked about a lot in the New Testament. It's a significant thing. But the story isn't really about Abraham's faith. What it was really about is God's faithfulness. Because in the midst of his up and downs, in the midst of what will be Israel's up and downs, in the midst of our up and downs, God is faithful. He's not letting us go. He's not cutting off the journey because of a bad decision we made. He is continually coming back to us and saying, be part of this with me. Be in this relationship with me. Don't cling to the lesser things. Choose what is better. Follow me. And that leads a question for us. Are we the kind of people who are going to choose the blesser over the blessing? And it's not an easy question to answer. And different days we might answer it differently. But I want to be the kind of person who isn't so stuck on the things that are in front of me, the things that I would consider to be mine, that I miss out on what God might have for me next. I want to be the kind of person who lays it all out on the table, puts it all before God and says, God, these are blessings that you have given me, but they come from you. And so if you've got something else in store for me, I want to be on that train. That's what Abraham did in this story. That's why I hope we choose to do as people who follow God, to choose the blesser over the blessing. As we go throughout this week and we begin to contemplate all the ways that God has given us things, we should definitely be filled with gratitude. Gratitude that the God who created the heavens and the earth is the same God who sees us through the battles and the struggles and the trials, the good times and the bad. This same God who made it all is with us on this journey. I want to be a part of that. Could we be a people who will always choose the journey with God over the momentary stops when he gives us some things in pursuit of what is really good? Because we serve a God who wants to be on a journey with us now and forever. God, this is not always an easy thing to choose. We tend to get comfortable. I tend to get very comfortable. I acknowledge that you've given me a lot of great things in life, and I'm grateful for that. But God, sometimes I hide behind that, and the comfort of what you've given me prevents me from going further with you. God, I don't want that. I want to be a person who chooses you time and time again, who chooses the blesser over the blessing. Give me the faith and strength to make that decision. Us, as a people who are choosing to honor you with our lives, give us the strength to make that decision to time and time again choose you over everything else. In your name we pray. Amen.